Hello, I'm Greg. Let's have an inappropriate conversation about 42 questions. This is almost like an episode of ABC's TV show, What Would You Do? I'm trying to imagine what would happen if I lived in New York City and was called to the jury pool and was presented with 42 questions from the court on whether or not I would be eligible to be seated as a juror in the trial of a former president. A former president who is running for president again, and a former president who is accused of committing various crimes, some of them accounting-related, some of them campaign finance-related, in connection with his original run for president that put him into office in 2016, well, 2017, from an inauguration perspective. And if you were presented with these questions, how would you answer them? Because it's interesting to me from two perspectives. First, what are the questions? That was kind of what led me to go find the answer to that question and look at the 42 questions really briefly, because I didn't want to spoil the opportunity to look at the questions from the perspective of what if you were in the jury pool? What if they were trying to fill the 12 jurors and the six alternates, and you had literally been seated in the jury box and presented with these questions? Now, the actual questionnaire that came to prospective jurors when they were called to jury duty says, do not read the question itself. Just give us the number and the answer in a loud, clear voice. And depending on your answer, you know, there may be follow-up questions. In the case of a podcast, there won't be any follow-up questions, obviously. But it is fair to say that this is going to be similar enough to what you'd experience if you were answering, except I'm going to read the questions so we know what we're talking about. And despite the fact that there's 42, there's going to be a handful of them that don't require an answer, because I don't live in New York State. I don't live in New York City. I haven't been called to this particular jury. So I'm going to have to pretend that in the state I live in, and with information relevant from a perspective of my current employment and so forth and so on, I'll answer the questions that way. So in other words, if they're asking how long I've lived in a particular place, then you know the answer is more than 30 years, but it's not 30 years in New York. So, and I won't give a ton of detailed answers for things which are unimportant to the concept of an inappropriate conversation, where I live, who my employer is. These are things that I've always sort of kept walled off and separate from the podcast because they're not terribly relevant to the podcast. And part of the reason I do that is to try to put the focus on ideas. Inappropriate conversations is all about those not-for-dinner topics, saying let's feel free to have conversations about politics, religion, popular culture, sex, drugs, rock and roll, what have you. Things that might be frowned upon when I was growing up if these concepts were to come up during family dinner, especially if it was an event like a Thanksgiving or an Easter or something along those lines. I am in that sense trying to be politically incorrect. But some personal details are irrelevant to that. In fact, they sort of hamper it. If you were a New York City prospective juror, for example, you might be a little bit concerned about how some of the information that they're being asked here could identify them in such a way that if the information were reported, if someone were to violate the laws in New York and surreptitiously sneak out a recording, that just the first three or four questions have enough information to identify somebody. And we've already seen that in the process of jury selection for this trial, where one juror basically went to the judge and said, I can't serve on this juror because I'm afraid for my well-being. And I'm afraid for my well-being because my family already knew, without me saying so, with me trying my best to keep my identity as a potential juror secret, they already knew from the little information that was purported. And now, I've had previous Inappropriate Conversations episodes where I've talked about torment as tactic and whether or not we should be patient and tolerant at all about the entire process of doxing and whether it's appropriate for people to use a silencing technique of harassment. You know, when I was in high school, there was one point where my family just kind of needed to take the upstairs phone and permanently leave it off the hook at night, because I was getting harassing phone calls at all hours of the night by a girl that I had started maybe potentially dating, and then I decided not to pursue it. She didn't take that well, and her or her friends, and this is all conjecture on my part, but the harassing phone calls came from someplace, right? And we've had cases. Christine Blasey Ford, for example, when she testified in the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh's eligibility to the U.S. Supreme Court, had to take her family out of their home and flee to an undisclosed location because of the harassment that she was receiving. So as I get into some of the questions, I'm going to do what some of the jurors wish they could have done and say, yeah, there's no reason for me to answer a question like that. Beginning with question one, without telling us your address, in what neighborhood do you live? For example, Upper East Side, Lower West Side, Inwood, etc. Not going to answer that question. Not relevant. How long have I lived there? This house that I'm in now, more than 20 years. The city that I live in, more than 30 years. Currently, I'm living in this place longer than any other place I've ever lived in my life. Am I native to the place I live? Question 1C, are you a native New Yorker? If not, where did you live previously? No, I'm not native to the place that I lived, but I've lived, again, here longer than any other place I've lived. And that milestone sort of surprised me when I realized one day that I actually lived in the state I'm in longer than the states I'd previously lived in. I kind of wasn't expecting that. I sort of thought that the state where I went to high school and college, that those years would be the dominant, that was a couple of decades. Well, this is now more than 3 decades. Question 2, what do you do for a living? How long have you been doing that? If you were retired, please tell us what you did before you retired. Yeah, that's a question I'm going to skip. You can understand why it would be relevant to the court. You also can understand how that was a particularly identifying set of questions for the juror who asked to be removed from the jury pool because of being identified. Question 3, who is your current employer? How large is your current employer? Are you self-employed or do you own your own business? Who was your prior employer? Again, as I've mentioned, those are questions I'm not going to answer. They're not relevant to this inappropriate conversation, and they would be the kind of things that would identify somebody if they were a juror trying to avoid, you know, what could be, the kind of people who stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, 2021. You wouldn't want them storming your house, would you? Question 4. What is your educational background? For example, high school diploma, college degree, graduate degree. I'm college degree. I've mentioned it in past inappropriate conversations. Inappropriate conversation number 44, I believe, is the first time I mentioned it on the show. That's a long time ago. That goes back to 2011, that memory. But yeah, I've got a Bachelor of Science in Journalism with minor degrees in English with a focus on film, political science, and religious studies. So that's sort of my educational background. Question 5. Are you married? Yes. Have you ever been married? Well, yes. Do you have any children? Yes. They're adult children. So I'm not sure that their ages strike. This question seems to be talking about my household, and I don't have children in my household right now. Question 6. If you are married or living with another adult, what does that person do for a living? And if you have adult children, what do they do for a living? Just like I'm not going to answer questions about my own employment specifics, I'm certainly not going to answer questions about my wife and my kids' employment. I would if I were in the jury pool, but not relevant to a podcast. Question 7. What do you do in your spare time? Do you have any interests or hobbies? Well, that's interesting. I think my experience inside the process of jury selection would get really interesting on this point when I say, I've got a couple of podcasts, and I appeared as a guest on several others. I don't know if it's a dozen, but, you know, more than a handful of others where I've had guest appearances on shows like Do Ask, Do Tell, Atomic Trivia War 9000, Books You Should Read, other shows where I've appeared in conversations about a variety of topics. Most of them popular culture, but on the Take Him With You podcast, that was talking about religion, spirituality, and and certain current events as they apply to religion and spirituality. That's certainly a key hobby of mine. I'm also a big fan of music and movies. I think I recently mentioned that I kind of broke Spotify. I didn't break it, but I crossed a limit in Spotify. If I had my way, I would have a primary playlist on a streaming device that had more than 25,000 songs on it. And then I could just go into that playlist and hit shuffle, and all the songs that I've ever liked, regardless of the artist, regardless of the genre, regardless of the year it was made, just mix it up in a big old gumbo and serve it to me like a stew. That's how I feel about music. And I recently had to split that, you know, primary playlist up into two parts because I breached the limit. Couldn't have 10,000 songs on a playlist. So there could end up being a time in the future where if I continue to explore music the way I like to explore it, I'm going to end up with a third one of those playlists because that's how into music I am. And it is quite literally music of almost every conceivable genre. So there's no particular bias or predilection there. I also love movies. I've had a little bit of time off in the past few months, and I've used that time to catch up on movies, and that includes, for me, a lot of foreign films and art house films. I've probably seen more films in Spanish and Italian in the year 2024 than I had in the previous 7, 8, 9 years combined. So, habits that involve, you know, consuming media. I also have been going to the gym a lot more lately, and though I'm never going to be the kind of person who would be on a rec league basketball team, I do shoot a fair amount of hoops, and I spend a fair amount of time on a stationary bike, so I get some mix of sedentary and active kind of hobbies, but most of it is things that I would watch, listen to, or read. Question 8. Do you participate in any organization or advocacy groups, and which ones? Well, I'm very active in my church, and I would probably think of that as being arguably an organization or an advocacy group. But I've often had the mentality that I've heard ascribed to Woody Allen that I'm not sure I'd want to be a member of any group whose criteria was so low that I could become a member of the group. That when it comes to the Odd Fellows or the Eagles or any of those kinds of civic organizations or clubs, you know, I think my dad was a member of one of them. I'm trying to remember which one it was, but I've never really been part of that. And I'm certainly not, you know, signed up as a kind of standing member of any advocacy group. So later on, they're going to ask questions about things like, you know, Antifa. And if they asked about the, I'm not even signed up for the American Association of Retired Persons, although I'm technically eligible. I tend to avoid groups, I guess, short of my church. Number 9, have you ever served on a jury before? The answer is no, but I'll finish the question. If you did, please tell us how long ago that was and whether it was in criminal court, civil court, or a grand jury. And without telling us the verdict, please tell us whether the jury reached a verdict. You can see how that would be interesting to the court, understanding whether somebody has been part of a hung jury before, and the follow-up questions would probably be related to, you know, the situation that led to the jury that the person was on being unable to reach a verdict. I've been called a couple of times in the sense of being told by the community I live that I'm on the list for jury duty. But the way it works in the area that I live is you get a notification, usually via mail, you get a number, and then you call in, and you don't go to the courthouse until your number is needed. So if I got a letter like that and I was number 16 or 17, then I can almost guarantee I was going to be going to the courthouse and working my way through the process of whether I could or could not be seated on a jury. But I think the lowest number I've ever gotten is 90, and I think I've been up in the hundreds before. And if you get a number like 90 and it's a holiday week, I'm trying to remember which holiday, whether it was Labor Day or Independence Day, but there's a day in that week where the court isn't in session because of a national holiday, even that limits the likelihood that your number is going to come up. So my number never came up. I never needed to tell my employer that I need to be off today because I'm going to be at the courthouse and I don't know if I'm going to be seated on a jury yet. For me, that answer was no. Number 10, which of the following print publications, cable and or network programs, or online media such as websites, blogs, or social media platforms do you visit, read, or watch? And read those aloud. I'm going to read the entire list, but before I do, let me start with my answer primarily being that through Google and Facebook and a magazine that's not on this list at all, I usually get redirected to other things. So I don't go to the New York Times, for example. But oftentimes I will get a link to an article from the New York Times in a digest that comes to me either through MSN.com or Google or Facebook or someplace like that. So my answer is really simple. It's kind of no to almost all of these. If you leave out podcasts, podcasts will come to in a minute. So their list was New York Times. And again, if they're talking about, do I subscribe? Am I through their paywall? Do I go to their website? No. USA Today? No. I was, however, employed at a newspaper that was part of Gannett News Service, but I wasn't employed by USA Today proper. I was one of the many daily newspapers that they own across the country, and this was kind of in the heart of the country, pretty far away from Washington, D.C., or New York City, for that matter. New York Daily News, Huffington Post, CNN, MSNBC, again, all no in terms of, do I actively go to the website and consume my news from that vehicle? Am I paying any subscriptions where subscriptions are necessary? No. Google, Facebook, X, as I mentioned up front, those are things where I will see and gather news stories, and then those news stories will lead me either to follow a link or to pursue my own path to get corroborating information. TikTok, no. But if you look at Reels on Facebook, you are basically seeing Instagram videos and TikTok videos. So I have seen several TikTok videos, but not by logging into TikTok. At one point, my work didn't require but strongly encouraged us to set up a TikTok account and to do so in conjunction with a Halloween promotion of some sort where I dressed up in costume and took a short video. But that was very short-lived. I was on the platform long enough to shoot that video, enter into the company's promotional contest, and then I stopped using the app, removed it from my phone, all that. Wall Street Journal, no. New York Post, no. Newsday, no. Washington Post, no. You know, I might use some of those publications more often, but I'm unwilling to pay because I don't know that I would get as much as I would need to out of the cost of subscribing to get through an online paywall. Fox News, generally no. Sometimes, again, to avoid confirmation bias, I will look there when I see a story somewhere else just to see kind of the other perspective. Newsmax, no. MSN, yes, like Google, to that extent. Yahoo, to a lesser extent, yes, like Google. With MSN and Yahoo, if I'm accessing an Outlook mailbox, and it's the best way to access it is through MSN.com or through Yahoo.com, I will see news stories that way, and sometimes I'll click on them, sometimes I won't. True Social, no. I do not follow the news. That's a no, I do. Other, you know, I don't know that I need to answer the other. I have been given, through a charitable process of trying to support a youth who was selling magazines, I bought a one-year subscription to the New Republic. This is an interesting time to be reading that magazine because of everything going on in the Middle East and the fact that the historic orientation of the New Republic as a magazine has been very pro-Israel. So it's a very interesting to read a magazine that has, I'm guessing, a liberal perspective on the spectrum, but also a very pro-Israel perspective. The main reason I've always read historically articles in the New Republic is because of their film reviews. Inappropriate Conversations number 50 cited Stanley Kaufman as a different drummer. I cited him there because I think Stanley Kaufman, I still believe Stanley Kaufman is the greatest film critic who has ever lived, and most of his work in print form was published by the New Republic. Question 11. Do you watch or listen to podcasts? If so, which ones? That is an insanely loaded question, and I've spent a little bit of time today trying to figure out how I want to answer it, and I think I'm going to take a little time, because this is a way of promoting other shows that I like and enjoy and listen to. I will try to keep it to ones that I like and enjoy and listen to on a regular basis, because if I was standing inside that jury box and somebody was asking me which podcasts I listen to, I think my first question back to the judge or the lawyer who asked the question is, how much time do you have? We could spend the next 45 minutes with me just talking about podcasts that I do listen to, have listened to, or hope in the future to listen to. So let's keep that question really literally and say, hey, you know what? What do I listen to on a very regular basis? And I'll do that by looking both in Spotify and in another podcatcher, because I listen to so many podcasts, I don't even consume them all in the same way. Go figure. So let me start with Spotify, is my way of looking at question 11 in the appropriate amount of detail. My list there would be NPR Fresh Air, the NPR Politics podcast, Men and Blazers, which is a sports soccer podcast, other sports-related podcasts that go back to my alma mater and where I went to school, TED Talks Daily, Audio Poem of the Day, Stuff Your Mother Never Told You, that podcast, Stuff You Should Know, Gayish podcast, and just willing to say, hey, just about everything on Pride48.com is a podcast that I'm going to listen to. The Solid Verbal is a college football podcast. I pay a good deal of attention to that. I spend some time with the JV Club, a Janet Varney podcast. She's an actress who does interviews of other people, typically actors. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, the 1001 Album Club, the Alex Wagner Tonight and the Rachel Maddow Show. Both of those are MSNBC podcasts. Other sports podcasts related to like the Kansas City Chiefs. When we get into college softball playoffs, I'll put the Seventh Inning podcast for that back in regular rotation, because that's something I pay a lot of attention to. Musically, there's a Fallout podcast that's all about the band The Fall. Then if I jump over to my other podcatcher just to see if there's anything that I miss that I consume somewhere else, BBC Four in England has a Thought for the Day podcast. It's a religion and spirituality is the focus, but it's a variety of different religions. It's very ecumenical in tone. Max Lucado has a one-minute daily devotional that I will listen to quite a bit. Obviously, I listen to my own, Inappropriate Conversations and Walk the Earth, if only just to make sure that those podcasts are, you know, rendering properly and that they can be consumed in the manner that they're intended. Other Pride 48 podcasts that get a lot of my attention, just to mention some more of those in this other podcatcher, Pod is My Co-Pilot, Greetings from Nowhere, Matinee Minutia, The Smellcast, those kinds of shows. On the movie front, the B-Movie Podcast, Forgotten TV, Forgotten Filmcast, those I spend quite a bit of time with. NPR's Mountain Stage is a live concert podcast. The Hustle, another music podcast. Stuck in the 80s, a pop culture podcast. World Cafe is a music and interview podcast. Amateur Traveler, the Naxos Classical Music Podcast, You Must Remember This, which is not a listen to it every week, because that particular show comes out in seasons where there'll be several weeks in a row of shows and then several months where they're on hiatus. Right now they're on hiatus, but when You Must Remember This is back, I'm absolutely certain I'll be listening to it. The Puritan's Guide to the Fall, that's another music podcast related to the band The Fall. Talking Pictures is one I've got queued up. I haven't really dived in yet, but I've got 10 episodes ready to go for a long plane flight or some other situation where it makes sense that I can dive in. That's just a hint. There are more. And historically, there have been more. So if somebody wanted to say, hey, NPR Politics, the Alex Wagner podcast from MSNBC.com, ooh, red flags. Well, there you go. But just understand that kind of interest in politics is kind of buried inside a social media souffle that has a variety of other things in it. As you probably expect, movies, music, religion and spirituality, pop culture, and a little bit of politics. Question 12. Do you listen to talk radio? If so, which programs? I don't listen to talk radio. That was a bad habit I gave up a long time ago. Question 13. Have you, a relative or close friend, ever been the victim of a crime? If so, briefly tell us what happened. I don't think I need to briefly tell a podcast audience what happened. The best example I have for being the victim of a crime, and this means, you know, not like being the victim of shoplifting as the manager of a store in a mall, but actually me personally being the victim of a crime, is Inappropriate Conversations number 113, Raised on Robbery. And I do talk a little bit there, quite a bit there, about what it means to be staring down the barrel of a gun pointed at you by somebody who is basically threatening to kill you if you don't do exactly what they say. Yes, I've been the victim of a crime. what happened was the police showed up. We made a statement. They never caught the people who robbed the movie theater I was in. We never got the money back. But I did get a letter of commendation from that movie theater company because my work in the box office, the manager of that theater's work, helped limit the amount of money that was stolen, which probably limited the number of future similar robberies that were happening. It's a big risk to commit armed robbery with a gun. That's a lot of years in prison that you've got staked as one piece of collateral if you only walk away with $150 total, especially if you only walk away with $150 or whatever it was on a night where that particular twin theater made thousands of dollars. I mean, $10,000 or $20,000 profit or take that day. 14. Have you, a relative or a close friend, ever been employed by a law enforcement agency? The police, the FBI, the district attorney's office, Department of Correction? I'm going to say the answer to this question is no. I do have an online friend that I've never met in person and never expect to meet in person, who for a while worked in a jail as a corrections officer. But again, close friend, that doesn't meet the criteria necessarily for close friend. I think you at least need to have seen the person. And if there's one or two people that I've interacted with online where that is true, you've got to weigh that against the fact that I've interacted with thousands of people online, either through my own podcast or the podcasts of others. Question 15. Have you, a relative or a close friend, ever been employed by a federal, state, or local government, including but not limited to the state of New York? Well, in the case of New York, no. In the case of other states and cities where I've lived, if you count school teachers, well, then the answer is yes. But in the state where I live, I did have a close friend who worked as a school teacher for a while, but she doesn't work as a school teacher anymore, and she doesn't live in the state that I live in anymore. So I'm going to go with the answer no, because if I lived in New York, my answer would be no for New York, and living in the state that I live in, the answer is also no. Ever been employed? Yes, but come on. School teacher? Decades ago? Okay. Question 16. Have you, a relative or close friend, ever been employed in the accounting or finance field? You know, I used to work for a retail organization. That retail organization had a lot of, I had a lot of interaction with people who worked in finance and accounting. Those were work relationships. It's not like my, you know, some like roommate in college that I still keep in touch with is actively working in a finance or an accounting field. But I do consider those work friends friends. So I probably could name a dozen people who have worked or still work in a retail finance department, either doing treasury or accounting activities. So, yes. 17. Have you, a relative or close friend, ever had any education, training, or work experience in the legal field, including but not limited to practicing criminal or civil law? Yes, I have a brother and his wife are both lawyers. Question 18. Have you, a relative or close friend, had any experience or interaction with the criminal justice system, including a police officer or other type of law enforcement agent, which caused you to form an opinion, whether positive or negative, about the police or our criminal justice system? If so, what was that experience, and would that experience prevent you from being a fair and impartial juror in this case? The best example of that is still Inappropriate Conversations, number 113, Raised on Robbery. My experience there was, you know, I guess positive but mixed. I thought the police officers handled themselves well. I do relate that in that past podcast. Nothing good came from it in the sense that we never got our money back. The criminals were never apprehended. I spent quite a bit of time worrying about the fact that I could identify them to some degree, and they knew that, and they weren't apprehended. And there was a period of time where I was, you know, maybe 6 to 8 months, constantly on guard that, you know, maybe I'd encounter somebody at a gas station or somewhere, and they would recognize me as the person they held up, but I might not recognize them, which would put me in a disadvantage in the sense of protecting myself. It was a mixed situation where the police were unable, and probably to no fault of their own, to come up with the resolution that I desired from that situation. But at the same time, it was a positive interaction when it actually happened. I was very glad to see the police that day. There have been other occasions where getting pulled over for a speeding ticket or whatnot, you're less glad to see the police. And I'm well aware of the fact that there are a lot of people in a variety of communities that have had different, and in cases, really negative experiences with police. I have friends who are gay. I have friends who are black. They can tell me stories. Those are not my stories. And I would not allow those stories to make me unfair or impartial to any testimony that might come in from anybody in law enforcement. Question 19. Have you, a relative, or a close friend ever been accused of or convicted of committing a crime? No, unless you include traffic violations. I've paid a couple of fines over the years. Question 20. Do you, a relative or close friend, have a pending criminal case? No. Question 21. Do you have any political, moral, intellectual, or religious beliefs or opinions which might prevent you from following court's instructions on the law, which might slant your approach in this case? And do you have any political, moral, intellectual, religious beliefs or opinions that would interfere with your ability to render a verdict in this criminal case? My personal religious beliefs are very slanted toward render unto Caesar's that which is Caesar. That I have no religious beliefs that tell me that I don't have to respect what a judge says or the instructions that I'm given as a juror. And I certainly would not say that I couldn't render a verdict because of my faith or any other opinions, whether they be political, moral, intellectual, or otherwise. Question 22. Do you have a health condition that might interfere with your ability to be here on the appointed days or times or otherwise prevent you from serving as a juror? No. Without telling us the names, do you take any medication that would prevent you from being able to concentrate or pay attention during the proceedings or during the deliberations? No. Question 24. Court proceedings normally end around 4:30 in the afternoon, though on rare occasions we might work beyond that. Would your schedule and responsibilities permit you to work later if it were absolutely necessary to complete that day's work? No. One of the things that you sign up for when you go to a jury, I think, is a mental expectation that at some point, whether it be in deliberations or otherwise, there's going to be a long day or two. No, not a problem. Question 25. Do you practice a religion that would prevent you from sitting as a juror on any particular weekday or weeknight? No. I've got a very flexible religious calendar, I guess is the way I would put it. My belief is that I could worship wherever need be, any day, any week, any place, any time. So the commitment to be a juror shouldn't interfere with that. Question 26. Can you give us an assurance that you will be fair and impartial and not base your decision in this case upon bias or prejudice in favor of or against a person who may be appear in this trial on account of that person's race, color, national origin, ancestry, gender, gender identity or expression, religion, religious practice, age, disability, sexual orientation, or political views? I can assure that I would be impartial, and I can also say I'm really glad that question is on this questionnaire. It's ironic, but I wonder if there's some people who would look at how pleased I am that a question like that about impartiality based on things that people are typically prejudiced against other people about is a good thing, as some kind of a negative thing. Could there be a lawyer somewhere in that courtroom and saying, this guy's commitment to everybody being treated with dignity and respect is a real problem for me, get him off this jury? That would be weird. So not a problem being fair and impartial across those elements. 27. Can you promise to guard against allowing stereotypes or attitudes about individuals or groups of people referred to as implicit bias influence your decision? Yes, I can promise to guard against that. Question 28. Have you, a relative or close friend, ever worked for any company or organization that is owned or run by Donald Trump or anyone in his family? No. Question 29. And question 29, I think I'm going to have to detail all the elements. It's the longest question on the list. A, have you, a relative or close friend, ever worked or volunteered for a Trump presidential campaign, the Trump presidential administration, or any other political entity affiliated with Mr. Trump? B, have you ever attended a rally or campaign event for Donald Trump? C, are you signed up for or have you ever been signed up for, subscribed to, or followed by any newsletter or email listserv run by or on behalf of Mr. Trump or the Trump Organization? D. Do you currently follow Donald Trump on any social media site, or have you ever done so in the past? E. Have you, a relative or close friend, ever worked or volunteered for any anti-Trump group or organization? F. Have you ever attended a rally or campaign event for any anti-Trump group or organization? G. Are you signed up for, or have you ever been signed up for, subscribed to, or followed any newsletter or email listserv run by or on behalf of any anti-Trump group or organization? And H. Do you currently follow any anti-Trump group or organization on any social media site, or have you done so in the past? What a mouthful. Well, first, never part of the Trump campaign or the White House while he was there, never attended a rally, never signed up for any pro-Trump listserv. Do not follow Trump on social media. If I've done so in the past, it was only because I might have been following the official president of the United States on Twitter. And at some point in time, that changed from Obama to Trump to Biden. I don't follow the president of the United States on Twitter, to my knowledge. I barely use X anymore. And I certainly never followed him on any other social media. When it comes to anti-Trump groups or organizations, I can't speak for my relatives or close friends, meaning the answer is probably no. Because if it doesn't come up in our conversation, then how close is that friendship? And how accurately is that sense of what other members of my family may or may not be doing? It certainly isn't something I'm aware of, if they are. I have not attended a rally or campaign event for an anti-Trump group. And I'm not signed up to any sort of group. You know, again, as I mentioned earlier, I tend to be very anti-group. So when it comes to anti-Trump groups or organizations, the answer is no. Following social media sites that are anti-Trump or anti, as an organization, the answer is no. But I do follow a fair number of pastors, and a lot of those pastors are progressive. So when you think of people like Nadia Bolz-Weber, former Different Drummer, Sarah Bessie, also I believe a former Different Drummer, John Pavlovitz, definitely a former Different Drummer. The Different Drummer list on the podcast site at inappropriateconversations.org has a lot of people who have probably said a lot of negative things about a variety of presidents, including Trump, over the years. John Pavlovitz might be the best example of somebody who has a reputation for being quote-unquote anti-Trump, but he's an individual, not an organization. Question 30. Have you ever considered yourself a supporter of or belong to any of the following? The QAnon movement, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Boogaloo Boys, Antifa? I can say with a great deal of confidence that not only is the answer no, but this is a good example of that Woody Allen quote I shared earlier. I don't believe I would be accepted into any of those groups based on my views. Because I take such a strong moderate approach, my worldview antagonizes all extremes, both sides of the spectrum. Question 31. Do you have any strong opinions or firmly held beliefs about whether a former president may be criminally charged in state court? That's a weird question, and I think I would have to ask for clarification before I answered it if I was standing in the jury box at that time. I have strong opinions and feelings about the United States Constitution. I have strong opinions and feelings that everybody in this country should be treated equally in the eyes of the law. And if that qualifies as having a strong opinion about a former president, no longer president, being treated just like everyone else in the eyes of the law, then yeah, okay, I have strong opinions. But outside of that really bare bone, ethics 101, did you actually take a history class in high school kind of perspective, do my opinions go beyond that all people who are citizens should be treated equally? No, not really. Question 32. Do you have any feelings or opinions about how Mr. Trump is being treated in this case? Strong feelings, maybe not, but I certainly have a perspective that Mr. Trump, in this case, based on news coverage I've seen, is being treated with a great deal of deference. Whether that deference is excessive because he's a former president or he's currently a candidate for office, and that creates a lot of complications and difficulties, willing to grant all that. While at the same time, I'm well aware of the fact that his behavior and approach to this case and other legal cases is very different from what any other common citizen would be allowed to do without, at least serious, if not really serious, consequences in a court of law. Question 33. Can you give us your assurance that you will decide this case solely on the evidence you see and hear in this courtroom and the law as the judge gives it? Yes. That's really the point. So, yes. Question 34. Do you have any strong opinions or firmly held beliefs about former President Donald Trump or the fact that he is a current candidate for president that would interfere with your ability to be fair and impartial juror? I had strong feelings and opinions about President Obama, both Bushes before, Clinton before that, Trump, Biden. I've got strong opinions about people who presume to be in leadership positions, and there are cases where there is no doubt I have found the leadership of people in the role of president to be insufficient in my mind. I was disappointed by President Obama. I was disappointed by President Trump during the time that they were president. Having said that, I am very capable of making sure that that doesn't interfere with my ability to be a fair and impartial juror. This isn't a symposium where we're getting together and passing judgment on how somebody performed when they were president. I'm not really very interested at all about how somebody is performing or will perform in the near future as a candidate, because I do not believe that presidential elections are horse races or beauty pageants, so I don't really follow them that way. But if we wanted to get together at some future point after the trial and have a robust conversation about all the mistakes that were made by Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden, I'm there for it. But that's not what this is about. So can I be fair and impartial despite being a very active, patriotic, and committed citizen of the United States who's aware of what his government is and has been doing? Yeah, absolutely. Question 35. Have you read or listened to audio of any of the following books or podcasts by Michael Cohen or Mark Pomerantz? And if so, please let us know if what you have heard or read affects your ability to be a fair and impartial juror in this case. I do not read any of the books or follow any of the podcasts for either one of those men, so Disloyal, a Memoir, Mea Culpa, the podcast, Revenge, published in 2022, People versus Donald Trump, no, haven't even read the back cover of any of those books. Wasn't even aware of the podcast. And that's with somebody who's deeply aware of hundreds of podcasts. Question 36. The defendant in this case has written a number of books. Have you read or listened to audio of any one or more of these books? If so, which ones? You know, the person with a journalism degree, the former copy editor in me, wants to kind of say that this is not the most accurate question I've ever read. The defendant has written or co-written a number of books, none of which I have read, so no. Question 37. Do you have any opinions about the legal limits governing political contributions? I do have some opinions. I believe that political contributions absolutely should be transparent, that there shouldn't be any effort to hide that. If a corporation is trying to give by forcing employees to give, as if the contributions to a political campaign from a corporation was instead coming from individuals who worked for that corporation, I'd have a real problem with that. I don't think that corporations should treat their employees that way. I don't think that any effort to hide political activism is appropriate. I believe in honesty, truthfulness, and transparency. And I think we probably have just an issue over the last, well, since maybe 1975 with that in our country. And it's gotten worse maybe in the last 15 years. So that is an opinion about, you know, political contributions that I feel very strongly about. If we as a nation decided we wanted to get together and fund political campaigns differently, I'd be in favor of that too. I think that in some cases, multiple billions of dollars being spent on presidential campaigns every 4 years is really, it's really embarrassing to us as a nation when we have allies who need military aid, when we have people who are starving and homeless. You know, so I think something should be done about that. But that's about as strong as that opinion gets. Something should be done. I don't know exactly what it is. But I do know that step one that I'm firmly committed to is that people, including me, who give to political campaigns should be open, honest, and transparent about the giving. Question 38. Can you promise to set aside anything that you may have heard or read about this case and render your verdict based solely on the evidence presented in this courtroom and the law as given to you by the judge? Yes. I am not exactly a news hound, but I'm not sure how it's possible for somebody in this country to not be aware of some of this stuff, but you have to be able to separate news and even opinion that you receive from the seriousness of what is presented in the court and the directions given by the court on what the law is and how the law applies. Question 39. Can you give us your absolute assurance that you will refrain from discussing this case with anyone in any manner and from watching, reading, or listening to any accounts of this case during the pendency of the trial? I'd have a little bit of a question about better definition on the pendency of the trial. I absolutely can commit to following that guideline. But there will be a point, if I were a juror in this particular case, where as a juror who has a podcast, who does his duty, I've got a choice to make when that is all said and done. One choice is hide under a rock because of the fear of doxing or other sort of negative consequences, or steer into it and make sure that whatever I might be persecuted for, if some, you know, villagers with torches show up at my door, is very, very well documented. I've had friends and family members who've been on juries who shudder to describe the experience even now. That it, their experience in a particular case, rendering a particular verdict, was very traumatic for them, and they don't like to revisit it, and they certainly don't like to talk about it. I'm not wired that way. I'm more likely at some point to tell the story. I have a couple of mottos in my life. Live to tell the story is one of them. Life's an essay test. We're obliged to give essay answers is another one. And it's probably wrong for me to kind of insinuate that there's only two. But those two seem to apply to this question. Circling back to the question itself, can I give an assurance that I won't talk about the case during the case? Absolutely. Can I give an assurance that I'll never talk about the case again for the rest of my life? Well, then we should talk, because that doesn't seem right to me. But if there's some rule that says, you know what, for the first year after the trial to allow for some period of appeals, you need to, you know, manage and control what it is you share or publish about it, yeah, I would live within those rules. No problem. Question 40. Can you assure us that you will follow the judge's instructions on law, including instructions on the definition of reasonable doubt and the presumption of innocence? Absolutely. Question 41. The United States Constitution provides that a defendant has no burden to introduce any evidence or to testify in a criminal case. If Mr. Trump chooses not to testify or introduce any evidence, can you give us your assurance that you will not hold that against him? Yes. Again, the whole concept of appearing before a jury in a criminal case, that should be one of the base assumptions, that we're going to follow the Constitution, we're going to follow the rule of law, and as a juror, that means impartiality in matters such as that. Finally, question 42. Is there any reason why, whether it be bias or something else, that would prevent you from being fair and impartial if you were selected as a juror for this case? There's only one I can think of, and that is that if my family or loved ones or me personally were attacked by some outside group during the trial based on my representation in the jury, despite all efforts being made by me and other people to keep that my presence on the jury a confidential court matter, if I were suddenly targeted because of something that was being said outside the courtroom but about the case that created severe negative consequences for me or my family, it would be extremely difficult to remain fair and impartial in that situation. If the district attorney left the courtroom after one session and identified me or my family by name and called me out because he didn't like my demeanor in the courtroom or the answers to these questions rubbed the district attorney the wrong way, I would have a very difficult time being fair and impartial about the district attorney's case against this defendant in a situation like that. And that, of course, applies both ways. But I think all of us are trusting that the judge and the courtroom, and frankly the media, are going to do everything in their power to make sure that is not a distracting issue for me or for any other juror if I lived in New York and been called into this jury pool for this particular case against a former president of the United States of America. For a very long time now, I've wanted to name S. Epatha Merkerson as a different drummer. I've got a notes file that I maintain for future shows, and she's been on there, and I've got her on there for something that I was considering as a topic that I was going to call an anti-cornerstone address. If there's time today, I might lean into that just a little bit to talk about what that means and why I thought of her in that context. But essentially, I'm naming her as a performer, as an actress, and an actress who I think has made an impact through just her persistent presence, if nothing else. In the late 1980s, early 1990s, there were a couple of television programs, one a comedy, one a drama, that for me kind of changed the way I'd seen either sitcoms or Law & Order type shows presented in the past. One was Seinfeld. I watched Seinfeld because it was different. And the other was Law & Order. And I was watching Law & Order pretty much from the very beginning. Can't make a claim that I've seen every episode, but whenever I would see an episode, like starting like season two or three on, one of the presences that I was always looking for was the Lieutenant Van Buren character, portrayed by Sharon Pathan Merkerson in that show. She has the distinction of being the person who has appeared in the longest running series of television programs as a black actress, that her relationship to that character has broken all records when it comes to women who are African-American playing a character on television over a persistent period of time. And that alone is really impressive. But to be honest, I couldn't put together a clip of my favorite Law & Order moments of all time, especially if it was a clip focused on Merkerson's work, without including her season one appearance as well, because her role in that was the first time I think I'd seen her as an actor in a show, short of maybe seeing her in a glancing way in She's Got a Habit or Jacob's Ladder. But I remember her from a season one Law & Order episode playing the mother of a kid who was killed sort of collateral damage in a gang-related drive-by shooting. She was Mrs. Denise Winters on Law & Order before she was Lieutenant Anita Van Buren on Law & Order. And I've seen interviews later where she said that she came to the show Law & Order first as a fan, then as somebody trying to audition for a role that, in my opinion, really made a difference in that show. The previous Lieutenant was great, but Law & Order was enhanced greatly by her perspective. Episodes where her dealing with cancer or her dealing with a mugging were different and hit differently because it was a female character who was dealing with those issues than it would have if it was a male character. Wikipedia has this to say about S.C. Pathan Merkerson. Born Sharon Pathan Merkerson in 1952, she is an American actress. She's received accolades for her work, including an Emmy Award, a Golden Globe Award, a Screen Actors Guild Award, 4 NAACP Image Awards, 2 Obie Awards, and 2 Tony Award nominations. She is known for her portrayal of NYPD Lieutenant Anita Van Buren on NBC's police procedural Law & Order, multiple versions of Law & Order, including a video game, apparently. This is a role that she played from 1993 to 2010, appearing in 388 episodes of the series. She's also known for playing Reba the Mail Lady on Pee-wee's Playhouse and Sharon Goodwin on the NBC medical drama Chicago Med, since that series premiered in November of 2015, including crossover appearances on the other Chicago procedurals, Chicago Fire and Chicago PD. This is an actress who's got a long resume, 62 acting credits, and a varied resume. A resume that goes from Pee-wee's Playhouse all the way to a relatively recent appearance in the one season that's been released so far on Peacock for Poker Face. Seeing her on that again was kind of a nudge I needed to say at some point, and to get back to recording, when you get back to recording, Merkerson needs a shout-out and credit for the quality and quantity of work that she's done. But the other thing that kind of initially nudged me in that direction was a program for the 2018 Kennedy Center Honors. Now, Merkerson wasn't the one being honored. In some ways, it was as impressive to me that she was one of the ones doing the honoring. That particular ceremony included Philip Glass. And she performed with a violinist part of Einstein on the Beach, because the Kennedy Center Honors television program is about introducing the person being honored and then having a variety of people speak to their work and their influence and help explain to an audience who may not know anything about Philip Glass why Philip Glass was important. Seeing Merkerson on that show and her really taking a great deal of pride and pleasure in being able to give back and recognize the work of a very contemporary artist like Philip Glass just sort of reminded me that she was the kind of person who needed a shout out as a different drummer. She's also spoken before without necessarily being an outright activist about it. She's been forthright and honest in interviews about issues related to how women in her field are treated, how black women in particular in her field are treated. And it's that finding that right balance of being open and forthright and not transparent, if you will, without necessarily being an activist that really works for this particular episode. Looking for the different drummer to pair with the 42 questions that prospective New York jurors are being asked in order to serve on this particular trial related to Donald Trump's allegedly criminal behavior in accounting and campaign finance. Those things kind of hit me in a couple of ways. First, you know, Anita Van Buren as a character on a show, very much law and order, more the order side than the law side, but very much law and order. But the other thing is, somebody who throughout her career has had to find a way to strike that balance between being honest and transparent and direct and clear, while also being, you know, not confrontational and negative and destructive. You know, the quote that I've shared before from Rabbi Pinchas of Corinth is that the world is a book that can be opened in either direction. There's the power to create, to make something out of nothing, and there's the power to destroy, to make nothing out of something. And it's people like Merkerson who helped create something where there was nothing before. NBC had given the Law & Order creative team an ultimatum, say there aren't enough female voices, there are not enough female representatives on this show, that the show was solid dramatically and had reasonably good ratings, but if there was a woman on the show, she was going to be a victim or a criminal, and they wanted them to do something about that. Merkerson helped the creative team of Law & Order do something about that in a history-making way. I mentioned in the intro the anti-cornerstone address concept, and I think it applies here when we're talking about a black actress as a different drummer. We're talking about presidential campaigns, including recent presidential campaigns by people like Ron DeSantis of Florida, and the current controversies that seem to be going on all over the country when it comes to schools and school boards, where Florida, for example, did you pick on Ron DeSantis a little bit, basically saying that slavery to him was some sort of a work training program, that it wasn't as bad as it seems. It's anti-American to have things in our textbooks which call out the moral wrong of slavery. And that efforts have been made both by the people in Texas who create these textbooks, by and large, and school boards in places led by governors like DeSantis to try to literally whitewash some of the uglier aspects of American history. This includes people, and it's not even, well, Nikki Haley in her presidential campaign was unable to actually articulate that the reason that the South seceded and the reason that the Civil War started was slavery. It took her days to come up with those words out of her mouth, as she recognized that a large number, maybe not a majority, but a large number of the people that she was hoping were going to vote for her were either slavery supporters or deniers of the evils of slavery and didn't want to connect the Civil War to slavery because some of those folks are still flying Confederate flags on their front yard. Here's what was actually said in the Cornerstone Address by Alexander H. Stephens, his Cornerstone speech, which was given in March 21st, 1861, Savannah, Georgia. So before the war broke out, he started this way. We are passing through one of the greatest revolutions in the annals of the world. Seven states within the last 3 months thrown off an old government and formed anew. This revolution has been signally marked up to this time by the fact of its having been accomplished without the loss of a single drop of blood. I'll stop there, because everything he was saying turned out to be total nonsense. His belief, apparently, was that if Fort Sumter attacked Union ships, that the Union would just say, we don't have time for this nonsense, let those states go do what they will and be who they are. Like, maybe Stevens wasn't expecting a civil war, or as a politician, Stevens was saying he wasn't expecting a civil war in a speech that was presented in Savannah, Georgia in 1861. No, this is what he actually had to say in the body of that speech. The new Constitution has put to rest forever, this is the South's Constitution, has put to rest forever all agitating questions related to our peculiar institution. Their peculiar institution, as he called it, was African slavery as it exists amongst us, the proper status of the Negro in our form of civilization. This was the immediate cause of the late rupture and present revolution. His words. I redlined them, but those are his words. Then he criticized Jefferson for, you know, not being strong enough in terms of supporting slavery at the time that the original Constitution was formed, saying this: the prevailing ideas entertained by Jefferson and most of the leading statesmen at the time of the formation of the old Constitution were that the enslavement of the African was in violation of the laws of nature, that it was wrong in principle, socially, morally, and politically. It was an evil that they knew not well how to deal with. But in the general opinion of the people of the day, that it was, you know, that was kind of it, that slavery is wrong, but we don't know what to do about it. But Stevens, in his cornerstone address, goes on to say, those ideas, however, were fundamentally wrong. They rested on the assumption of the equality of races, and this was an error. It was a sandy foundation, and the government built upon it fell when the storm came and the wind blew. Stevens, quoting Jesus of Nazareth, in an ugly and wrong way. His speech finished this way: our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth, he says, that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. The words I've just shared of Alexander H. Stevens' cornerstone speech, as it's called, are deeply, deeply offensive. They are words that need to be, well, first off, resurfaced and examined, because the state of Florida is pretending that those words were never spoken. It is not hard for me to find people, Trump-supporting people, who would say things like, well, yeah, Civil War was never really about slavery, or the Nikki Haley line. It was more about the rights of people to self-determination and decide what they want to do with their own property. No, this speech was a speech right before the first shots were fired in the Civil War. It was a statement of intent by somebody presuming to represent not just the new secessionist Southern government, but its very Constitution, and saying that its very Constitution is basically built upon the idea that slavery is right, that black people are inferior, and that we've got to secede from the Union to protect this unique institution, as he called it. No, it may be time for us to have an anti-cornerstone address in this country, something that fully and formally rejects those words from 1861, and the trend that we're seeing today, public school curriculum and in other places, that seem to, oh, not outright support it, because it's so embarrassing to say that you believe that, but calling slavery anything other than the moral, intellectual, philosophical evil that Stevens credits our founding fathers with calling it, and just not knowing what to do about it at the time of an American Revolution, that's the right thing to do. To call slavery evil, to teach in our schools that it's evil, and to correct all of the whitewashing that has happened at the hands of governors like DeSantis, presumably political candidates like Nikki Haley and others. And if that address were to be spoken, were to be read by somebody with professional skills in reading off a script, I wouldn't mind hearing the voice of S.E. Patha Murkerson sharing those words. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
Kevin MacLeod.
This show is part of the Pride 48 Network.
Find all the best shows under the rainbow at Pride48.com.